dream of the day I'd be sailing off myself. The boys at the post office tell me I'm lucky to get the Carmody family telegram, a shilling tip, one of the biggest you'll ever get in Limerick. So why am I getting it? I'm the junior boy. They say, well, sometimes Teresa Carmody answers the door. She has the consumption, and they're afraid of catching it from her. She's 17, in and out of the sanatorium, and she'll never see 18. The boys at the post office say sick people like Teresa know there's little time left, and that makes them mad for love and romance and everything. Everything. That's what the consumption does to you, say the boys at the post office. I cycle through wet November streets, thinking of that shilling tip, and as I turn into the Carmody Street, the bicycle slides out from under me, and I skid along the ground, scraping my face and tearing open the back of my hand. Teresa Carmody opens the door. She has red hair. She has green eyes like the fields beyond Limerick. Her cheeks are bright pink and her skin is a fierce white. She says, oh, you're all wet and bleeding. I skidded on my bike. Come in, and I'll put something on your cuts. I wonder, should I go in? I might get the consumption, and that'll be the end of me. I want to be alive when I'm 15, and I want the shilling tip. Come in. You'll perish standing there. She puts on the kettle for the tea. Then she dabs iodine on my cuts, and I try to be a man and not whimper. She says, oh, you're a great bit of a man. Go into the parlor and dry yourself before the fire. Look, why don't you take off your pants and dry them on the screen of the fire? Ah, no. I do. I will. I drape my pants over the screen. I sit there watching the steam rise, and I watch myself rise, and I worry she might come in and see me in my excitement. There she is with a plate of bread and jam and two cups of tea. Lord, she says, you might be a scrawny bit of a fellow, but that's a fine boy all you have there. She puts the plate and the cups on a table by the fire, and there they stay. With her thumb and forefinger, she takes the tip of my excitement and leads me across the room to a green sofa against the wall. And all the time my head is filled with sin and iodine and fear of consumption and the shilling tip and her green eyes, and she's on the sofa, don't stop or I'll die, and she's crying and I'm crying, for I don't know what's happening to me, if I'm killing myself, catching consumption from her mouth, I'm riding to heaven, I'm falling off a cliff, and if this is a sin, I don't give a fiddler's fart. We take our ease on the sofa a while till she says, don't you have more telegrams to deliver? And when we sit up, she gives a little cry. Oh, I'm bleeding. What's up with you? I think it's because it's the first time. I tell her, wait a minute. I bring the bottle from the kitchen and splash the iodine on her injury. She leaps from the sofa, dances around the parlor like a wild one, and runs into the kitchen to douse herself with water. After she dries herself, she says, Lord, you're very innocent. You're not supposed to be pouring iodine on girls like that. I thought you were cut. For weeks after that, I deliver the telegram. Sometimes we have the excitement on the sofa, but there are other days she has the cough, and you can see the weakness on her. She never tells me she has the weakness. She never tells me she has the consumption. The boys at the post office say, I must be having a great time with the shilling tip and Teresa Carmody. I never tell them I stopped taking the shilling tip. I never tell them about the green sofa and the excitement. I never tell them of the pain that comes when she opens the door and I can see the weakness on her. And all I want to do then is to make tea for her and sit with my arms around her on the green sofa. One Saturday, I'm told to deliver the telegram to Teresa's mother at her job in Woolworths. I try to be casual. Mrs. Carmody, I always deliver the telegram to your daughter, Teresa. Yes, she's in the hospital. Is she in the sanatorium? I said, she's in the hospital. She's like everyone else in Limerick, ashamed of the TB, and she doesn't give me a shilling or any kind of tip. I cycle out to the sanatorium to see Teresa. They say you have to be a relation and you have to be adult. I tell them I'm her cousin and I'll be 15 in August. They tell me, go away. I cycle to the Franciscan church to pray for Teresa. St. Francis, would you please talk to God? Tell him it wasn't Teresa's fault. I could have refused that telegram Saturday after Saturday. Tell God Teresa was not responsible for the excitement on the sofa, because that's what the consumption does to you. It doesn't matter anyway, St. Francis, because I love Teresa. I love her as much as you love any bird or beast or fish. And will you tell God take the consumption away, and I promise I'll never go near her again. The next Saturday, they give me the Carmody telegram. From halfway up the street, I can see the blinds are drawn. I could see the black crepe wreath on the door. I could see the white purple line mourning card. I could see beyond the door and walls where Teresa and I tumbled naked and wild on the green sofa. And I know now she's in hell and all because of me. I slip the telegram under the door and cycle back down to the Franciscan church to beg for the repose of Teresa's soul. I pray to every statue, to the stained glass windows, the stations of the cross. I swear I lead a life of faith, hope, and charity, poverty, chastity, and obedience. Next day, Sunday, I go to four masses. I do the stations of the cross three times. I say rosaries all day. I go without food and drink. And wherever I find a quiet place, I cry and beg God and the Virgin Mary to have mercy on the soul of Teresa Carmody. On Monday, I follow the funeral to the graveyard on my post office bicycle. I stand behind a tree, a distance from the grave. Mrs. Carmody weeps and moans. Mr. Carmody snuffles and looks puzzled. The priest recites the Latin prayers and sprinkles the coffin with holy water. I want to go to the priest, to Mr. and Mrs. Carmody. I want to tell them how I'm the one who sent Teresa to hell. They could do whatever they like with me, abuse me, revile me, throw grave dirt at me. But I stay behind the tree till the mourners leave and the grave diggers fill in the grave. Frost is already whitening the fresh earth on the grave, and I think of Teresa cold in the coffin, the red hair, the green eyes. I can't understand the feelings going through me, but I know that with all the people who died in my family, and all the people who died in the lanes around me, and all the people who left, I never had a pain like this in my heart, and I hope I never will again. It's getting dark. I walk my bicycle out of the graveyard. I have telegrams to deliver. Mrs. O'Connell gives me telegrams to deliver to Mr. Harrington, the Englishman with the dead wife that was born and bred in Limerick. The boys at the post office say sympathy telegrams are a waste of time. People just cry and moan with the grief, and they think they're excused from the tip. They'll ask you if you'd like to come in for a look at the departed and a prayer by the bed. That wouldn't be so bad if they offered you a drop of sherry and a ham sandwich. Oh, no, they're happy to get your prayer, but you're only a telegram boy, and you're lucky if you get a dry biscuit. Older boys at the post office say you have to play your cards right to get the grief tip. If you're asked in to say a prayer, you have to kneel by the corpse, give a powerful sigh, bless yourself, drop your forehead to the bedclothes so they won't see your face, let your shoulders shake like one collapsing with sorrow, hold on to the bed with your two hands, as if they're going to have to tear you away to deliver the rest of your telegrams. Make sure your cheeks are glinting with tears or the spit you dabbed on. And, if you don't get a tip after all that, push the next batch of telegrams under the door or fire them over the transom and leave them to their grief. This isn't my first time delivering telegrams to the Harrington house. Mr. Harrington is always away on business for the insurance company, and Mrs. Harrington is generous with the tip. But she's gone, and Mr. Harrington answers the doorbell. His eyes are red and he sniffles. He says, Are you Irish? Irish? Why, that's what I'd be standing there on his doorstep in Limerick with a batch of telegrams in my hand. I am, sir. He says, come in. Put the telegrams on the hall stand. He shuts the hall door, locks it, puts the key in his pocket, and I think, aren't Englishmen very peculiar? You'll want to see her, of course. You'll want to see what you people have done to her with your damn tuberculosis race of ghouls. Follow me. He leads me first to the kitchen, where he picks up a plate of ham sandwiches and two bottles, and then upstairs. Mrs. Harrington looks lovely in the bed, blonde, pink, peaceful. This is my wife. She may be Irish, but she doesn't look it, thank God, like you, Irish. You'll need a drink, of course. You Irish quaff at every turn. Barely weaned before you clamor for the whiskey bottle, the pint of stout. You'll have what? Whiskey? Sherry? A lemonade will be lovely. I am mourning my wife not celebrating the bloody citrus. You'll have a sherry. Swill from bloody Catholic fascist Spain. I got the sherry. He refills my glass and goes to refill his own with whiskey. Damn! Whiskey all gone. Stay here, do you hear me? I'm going to the pub for another bottle of whiskey. Stay till I come back. Don't move. I'm confused, dizzy from the sherry. I don't know what you're supposed to do with grieving Englishmen. Mrs. Harrington, you look lovely in the bed, but you're a Protestant already doomed in hell like Teresa. Priest said, outside the church there is no salvation. Wait. I might be able to save your soul. Baptize your Catholic. Make up for what I did to Teresa. I'll get some water. Oh, God, the door is locked. Why? Maybe you're not dead at all. Watching me. Are you dead, Mrs. Harrington? I'm not afraid. Your face is icy. Oh, you're dead, all right. I'll baptize you with sherry from bloody Catholic fascist Spain. I baptize thee in the name of the Father, the Son, the... What the bloody hell are you doing? Get off my wife, you wretched papist twit. What primitive paddy ritual is this? Did you touch her? Did you? I'll wring your scrawny neck. I speak English, you scrap. I was just a little sherry to get her into heaven. Heaven? We had heaven, and I, our daughter Emily. You'll never lay your pink piggy eyes on her. Oh, Christ, I can't stand it. Here, more sherry. I no thanks. And no thanks, that puny Celtic wine. You people love your alcohol, helps you crawl and whine better. Of course you want food. You have the collapsed look of a starving paddy. Here, ham. Eat. I no thanks. And no thanks. Say that again and I'll ram the ham up your ass. He waves a ham sandwich at me. With the heel of his hand, pushes it into my mouth. He collapses into a chair. Oh, God, God, what am I to do? Must rest a moment. My stomach heaves. I rush to the window, stick my head out and throw up. He leaps from the chair and charges me. You, God blast you to hell, you vomited on my wife's rosebush. He lunges at me, misses, falls to the floor. I climb out the window, hang onto the ledge. He's at the window, grabbing at my hands. I let go, drop to the rosebush, into the ham sandwich and sherry I've just thrown up. I'm pricked by rose thorns, stung. My ankle is twisted. He's at the window, barking, come back here, you Irish runt. He'll report me to the post office. He hits me in the back with the whiskey bottle, pleads, will you not watch 1 hour with me? He pelts me with sherry glasses, whiskey glasses, assorted ham sandwiches, items from his wife's dressing table, powders, creams, brushes. I climb on my bike and wobble through the streets of Limerick, dizzy with sherry and pain. Mrs. O'Connell attacks me. 7 telegrams, 1 address, and you're gone all day. I was... You was, drunk as what you was, drunk as what you are, reeking. All we heard, that nice man rang, Mr. Harrington, lovely Englishman that sounds like James Mason, let you in to say a prayer for his poor wife, and next thing you're out the window with the sherry and the ham. Your poor mother, what she brought into the world. He made me eat the ham, drink the sherry. Made you. Jesus, that's a good one. Made you. Mr. Harrington is a refined Englishman, and there's no reason for him to lie. And we don't want your kind in this post office. People that can't keep their hands off the ham and sherry. So, hand in your telegram pouch and bicycle, for your days are done in this post office. But I need the job. I have to save and go to America. America. Sad day when America lets in the likes of you. I hobble through the streets of Limerick. I'd like to go back and throw a brick through Mr. Harrington's window. No. Respect for the dead. I'll go across the Sarsfield Bridge and out the riverbank where I can lie down somewhere in the bushes. I don't know how I can go home and tell my mother I lost my job. Have to go home. Have to tell her. Can't stay out the riverbank all night. She'd be frantic. Ma'am begs the post office to take me back. They say, no. They never heard the likes. Telegram boy mauling cops. Telegram boy fleeing scene with ham and sherry. He will never set foot in the post office again. No. She gets a letter from the parish priest. Take the boy back, says the parish priest. Oh yes, father, indeed, says the post office. They'll let me stay till my 16th birthday. Not a minute longer. Besides, says Mrs. O'Connell, when you think of what the English did to us for 800 years, that man had no right to complain over little ham and sherry. Compare a little ham and sherry to the Great Famine, and where are you? If my poor husband was alive and I told him what you did, he'd say you struck a blow, Frank McCourt. Struck a blow. Every Saturday morning, I swear I go to confession and tell the priest of my impure acts at home, on lonely boreens around Limerick with cows and sheep gawking, on the heights of Carrigogunnel with the world looking up. I tell him about Teresa Carmody and how I sent her to hell, and that will be the end of me, driven from the church. Teresa is a torment to me. Every time I deliver a telegram to her street, every time I pass the graveyard, I feel the sin growing in me like an abscess. And if I don't go to confession soon, I'd be nothing but an abscess riding around on a bicycle with people pointing and telling each other, there he is, there's Frankie McCourt, the dirty thing that sent Teresa Carmody to hell. I look at people going to communion on Sundays, everyone in a state of grace, returning to their seats with God in their mouths. Peaceful, easy, ready to die at any moment and go straight to heaven, or go home to their rashes and eggs without a worry in the world. I'm worn out from being the worst sinner in Limerick. I want to get rid of this sin and have rashes and eggs and no guilt, no torment. I want to be ordinary. The priests tell us all the time that God's mercy is infinite. But how can any priest give absolution to someone like me, who delivers telegrams and winds up in a state of excitement on a green sofa with a girl dying of the galloping consumption? I cycle all around Limerick with telegrams and stop at every church. I ride from Redemptorists to Jesuits to Augustinians to Dominicans to Franciscans. I kneel before the statue of St. Francis of Assisi and beg him to help me. But I think he's too disgusted with me. I kneel with people in the pews next to confessionals. But when my turn comes, I can't breathe. My heart pounds. My forehead turns cold and clammy, and I run from the church. I swear I'll go to confession at Christmas. I can't. Easter. I can't. Weeks and months pass, and it's a year since Teresa died. I'll go on her anniversary. But I can't. I'm 15 now, and I pass churches without stopping. I'd have to wait till I go to America, where there are priests like Bing Crosby and going my way, who won't kick me out of the confessional like Limerick priests. I still have the sin in me, the abscess, and I hope it doesn't kill me entirely before I see the American priest. There's a telegram for an old woman, Mrs. Bridget Finucane. She says,
"How old are you, by?"
15 and a half, Mrs. Finucane.
"Young enough to make a fool of yourself and old enough to know better. Are you smart, by? Are you any way intelligent?"
"I can read and write, Mrs. Finucane."
"Are there are people above in the lunatic asylum can read and write. Can you write a letter?"
"I can." She wants me to write letters to her customers. "If you need a suit or dress for your child, you can go to her. She gives you a ticket to a shop, and they give you the clothes. She gets a discount and charges you the full price and interest on top. You pay her back weekly. Some of her customers fall behind in their payments, and they need threatening letters. She says,
'I'll give you threepence for every letter you write, and another threepence if it brings a payment. If you want the job, come here on Thursday and Friday nights, and bring your own paper and envelopes.'"
I'm desperate for that job. I want to go to America, but I have no money for paper and envelopes. Next day, I'm delivering a telegram to Woolworths, and there's the answer, a whole section packed with paper and envelopes. I have no money, so I have to help myself. But how? Two dogs saved the day for me. Two dogs at the door of Woolworths, stuck together after the excitement. They yelp and run in circles. Customers and sales clerks giggle and pretend to be looking someplace else. And while they're busy pretending, I slip paper and envelopes under my sweater, out the door, and off on my bike, far from stuck dogs.
Mrs. Finucane looks suspicious. "That's very fancy stationery you have there, by. Is that your mother's? You'll give that back when you get the money, won't you, by?"
"Oh, I will." From now on, I'm never to come to her front door. There's a lane behind her house, and I'm to come in the back door for fear someone might see me. In a large ledger, she gives me the names and addresses of 6 customers behind in their payments.
"Threaten them, by. Frighten the life out of them."
My first letter. "Dear Mrs. O'Brien, inasmuch as you have not seen fit to pay me what you owe me, I may be forced to resort to legal action. There's your son Michael parading around the world in his new suit, which I paid for, while I myself have barely a crust to keep body and soul together. I'm sure you don't want to languish in the dungeons of Limerick Jail, far from friends and family. I remain yours in litigious anticipation, Mrs. Bridget Finucane." She tells me,
"That's a powerful letter, by. Better than anything you'd read in the Limerick Leader. That word, inasmuch, that's a holy terror of a word. What does it mean?"
"I think it means this is your last chance." I write 5 more letters, and she gives me money for stamps. On my way to the post office, I think, why should I squander money on stamps when I have 2 legs to deliver the letters myself in the dead of night? When you're poor, a threatening letter is a threatening letter, no matter how it comes in the door. I run through the lanes of Limerick, shoving letters under doors, praying no one will see me. The next week, Mrs. Finucane,
pray of them paid. Oh, sit down now and write more, by. Put the fear of God in them.
Week after week, my threatening letters grow sharper and sharper. I begin to throw in words I hardly understand myself.
"Dear Mrs. O'Brien, inasmuch as you have not succumbed to the imminence of litigation in our previous epistle, be advised that we are in consultation with our barrister above in Dublin."
Next week, Mrs. O'Brien pays.
"She came in trembling with tears in her eyes, by, and she promised she'd never miss another payment."
On Friday nights,
Mrs. Finucane sends me to the pub for a bottle of sherry. You're too young for sherry, bye. You can make yourself a nice cup of tea, but you have to use the tea leaves left over from this morning. No, you can't have a piece of bread with the prices they're charging. Bread, is it? Next thing you'll be asking for an egg. She rocks by the fire, sipping her sherry, counting the money in the purse in her lap, entering payments in her ledger before she locks everything in the trunk under her bed upstairs. After a few sherries, she tells me what a lovely thing it is to have a little money, so you can leave it to the church for masses to be said for the repose of your soul. It makes her so happy to think of priests saying masses for her years and years after she's dead and buried. Sometimes she falls asleep, and if the purse drops to the floor, I help myself to an extra few shillings for the overtime and the use of all the big new words. There will be less money for the priests than their masses, but how many masses does a soul need? And surely I'm entitled to a few pounds after the way the church slammed doors in my face. They wouldn't let me be an altar boy, a secondary school pupil, a missionary with the White Fathers. I don't care. I have a post office savings account, and if I keep writing successful threatening letters, helping myself to the odd few shillings from her purse, and keeping the stamp money, I'll have my escape money to America. If my whole family dropped from the hunger, I wouldn't touch this money in the post office. Often I have to write threatening letters to neighbors and friends of my mother, and I worry they might discover me. They complain to Mam. That old bitch Finucane below in Irish town sent me a threatening letter. What kind of demon out of hell would torment her own kind with a class of a letter that I can't make head nor tail of anyway, with words never heard on land or sea? The person that would write that letter is worse than Judas or any informer for the English. My mother says anyone that writes such letters should be boiled in oil and have his fingernails pulled out by blind people. I'm sorry for their troubles, but there's no other way for me to save the money for America. I know that someday I'll be a rich Yank and send home hundreds of dollars, and my family will never have to worry about threatening letters again. Some of the temporary telegram boys are taking the permanent exam in August. Mrs. O'Connell says, "You should take the exam, Frank McCourt. You have a bit of a brain in your head, and you pass it, no bother. You'd be a postman in no time and a great help to your poor mother." Mam says I should take it too, become a postman, save up, go to America and be a postman over there. Wouldn't that be a lovely life? I'm delivering a telegram to South's pub on a Saturday, and Uncle Pat Keating is sitting there, all black as usual. He says, "Have a lemonade there, Frankie, or is it a pint you want now that you're near 16? "Lemonade, Uncle Pa, thanks. You'll want your first pint the day you're 16, won't you?" "I will, but my father won't be here to get it for me." "Don't worry about that. I know 'tis not the same without your father, but I'll get you the first pint. 'Tis what I'd do if I had a son. Come here the night before you're 16. "I will, Uncle Pa." "I hear you're taking that exam for the post office."
"I am."
"Why would you do a thing like that?"
"'Tis a good job, and I'd be a postman in no time, and it has the pension."
"Ah, pension, my arse. 16 years of age and talking about the pension? Is it codding me you are? Do you hear what I said, Frankie? Pension, my arse. If you pass the exam, you'll stay in the post office nice and secure the rest of your life. You'll marry a Bridget and have 5 little Catholics. And grow little roses in your garden. You'll be dead in your head before you're 30 and dried in your bollocks the year before. Make up your own bloody mind and to hell with the safe shots and the begrudgers. Do you hear me, Frankie McCourt?"
"I do, Uncle Pa. That's what Mr. O'Halloran said."
"What did he say?"
"Make up your own mind."
"True for Mr. O'Halloran. 'Tis your life. Make your own decisions and to hell with the begrudgers, Frankie. In the heel of the hunt, you'll be going to America anyway, won't you?"
I will, Uncle Pa. The day of the exam, I'm excused from work. There's a sign in an office window on O'Connell Street. Smart boy wanted. Neat handwriting. Good at sums. Apply here to manager, Mr. McCaffrey, Eason's Limited. I stand outside the place of the exam, the house of the Limerick Protestant Young Men's Association. There are boys from all over Limerick climbing the steps to take the exam, and a man at the door is handing them sheets of paper and pencils and barking at them to hurry up, hurry up! I look at the man at the door. I think of Uncle Pa Keating and what he said. I think of the sign in Easton's office, Smart Boy Wanted. I don't want to go in that door and pass that exam, for if I do, I'd be a permanent telegram boy with a uniform, then a postman, then a clerk selling stamps for the rest of my life. I'll be in Limerick forever, growing roses with my head dead and my bollocks all dried up. The man at the door says, You, are you coming in here? Are you going to stand there with your face hanging out? I want to say to the man, Kiss my arse. But I still have a few weeks left in the post office and he might report me. I shake my head and walk up the street where a smart boy is wanted. The manager, Mr. McCaffrey, says, I would like to see a specimen of your handwriting to see, in short, if you have a decent fist. Sit down there at that table. Write your name and address. And write me a paragraph explaining why you came here for this job and how you propose to rise in the ranks of Eason and Son Limited by dint of perseverance and assiduity, where there is great opportunity in this company for a boy that will keep his eye on the guide on ahead and guard his flanks from the siren call of sin. I write, Frank McCourt, 4 Little Barrington Street, Limerick City, County Limerick, Ireland. I am applying for this job so that I can rise to the highest ranks of Easons Limited by dint of perseverance and assiduity, knowing that if I keep my eyes ahead and protect my flanks, I'll be safe from all temptation and a credit to Easons and Ireland in general. What's this? Says Mr. McCaffrey. Do we have here a twisting of the truth?
I don't know, Mr. McCaffrey.
Little Barrington Street? That's a lane. Why are you calling it a street? You live in a lane, not a street.
They call it a street, Mr. McCaffrey.
Don't be getting above yourself, boy.
Oh, I wouldn't, Mr. McCaffrey.
You live in a lane, and that means you have nowhere to go but up. Do you understand that, McCourt?
I do, sir.
You have to work your way out of the lane, McCourt.
I do, Mr. McCaffrey.
You have the cut and jib of a lane boy, McCourt.
Yes, Mr. McCaffrey.
You have the look of the lane all over you. All over you from pole to toe cap. Don't try to fool the populace, McCourt. You'd have to rise early in the morning to fool the likes of me.
Oh, I wouldn't, Mr. McCaffrey.
Then there's the eyes. Very sore eyes you have there. Can you see?
I can, Mr. McCaffrey.
You can read and write, but can you do addition and subtraction?
I can, Mr. McCaffrey.
Well, I don't know what the policy is on sore eyes. I would have to ring Dublin and see where they stand on sore eyes. But your writing is clear, McCourt. A good fist. We'll take you on pending the decision on the sore eyes. Monday morning, 6:30 at the railway station.
In the morning?
In the morning. We don't give out the bloody morning papers at night, do we?
No, Mr. McCaffrey.
Another thing. We distribute the Irish Times, a Protestant paper, run by the Freemasons in Dublin. We pick it up at the railway station. We count it. We take it to the newsagents. But we don't read it. I don't want to see you reading it. You could lose the faith. And by the look of those eyes, you could lose your sight. Do you hear me, McCourt?
I do, Mr. McCaffrey.
No Irish Times. And when you come in next week, I'll tell you about all the English filth you're not to read in this office. Do you hear me?
I do, Mr. McCaffrey.
Mrs. O'Connell has the tight mouth, and she won't look at me. She says to Miss Barry, I hear a certain upstart from the lanes walked away from the post office exam. Too good for it, I suppose. True for you, says Miss Barry. Too good for us, I suppose. True for you. Do you think he'd ever tell us why he didn't take the exam? Oh, he might, says Miss Barry, if we went down on our two knees. I tell her, I want to go to America, Mrs. O'Connell. Did you hear that, Miss Barry?
I did indeed, Mrs. O'Connell.
He spoke.
He did indeed.
He will rue the day, Miss Barry.
Rue he will, Mrs. O'Connell.
Mrs. O'Connell talks past me to the boys waiting on the bench for the telegrams.
This is Frankie McCourt. He thinks he's too good for the post office.
I don't think that, Mrs. O'Connell.
And who asked you to open your gob, Mr. High and Mighty? Too grand for us, isn't he, boys?
He is, Mrs. O'Connell.
And after all we did for him, giving him the telegrams with the good tips, sending him to the country on fine days, taking him back after his disgraceful behavior with Mr. Harrington, the Englishman, disrespecting the body of poor Mrs. Harrington, stuffing himself with ham sandwiches, getting Fluther drunk on sherry, jumping out the window and destroying every rose bush in sight, coming in here, three sheets to the wind, and who knows what else he did, delivering telegrams for 2 years. Who knows indeed, though we have a good idea. Don't we, Miss Barry?
We do, Mrs. O'Connell, though 'twouldn't be a fit subject to be talking about.
Mrs. O'Connell whispers to Miss Barry, and they look at me and shake their heads.
A disgrace he is to Ireland and his poor mother. I hope she never finds out. But what would you expect of one born in America and his father from the north? We put up with all that and still took him back.
She keeps talking past me again to the boys on the bench.
Going to work for Easons he is, working for that pack of Freemasons and Protestants above in Dublin. Too good for the post office, but ready and willing to deliver all kinds of filthy English magazines all over Limerick. Every magazine he touches will be a mortal sin, but he's leaving now, so he is. And a sorry day it is for his poor mother that prayed for a son with a pension to take care of her in her latter days. So here, take your wages and go from the sight of us. Miss Barry says,
he's a bad boy, isn't he, boys?
He is, Miss Barry.
I don't know what to say. I don't know what I did wrong. Should I say I'm sorry? Goodbye? I lay my belt and pouch on Mrs. O'Connell's desk. She glares at me.
Go on. Go on to your job at Easons. Go from us. Next boy, come up for your telegrams.
They're back at work. And I'm down the stairs to the next part of my life. I don't know why Mrs. O'Connell had to shame me before the whole world. And I don't think I'm too good for the post office or anything else. How could I? With my hair sticking up, pimples dotting my face, my eyes red and oozing yellow, my teeth crumbling with the rot, no shoulders, no flesh in my arse after cycling 13,000 miles to deliver 20,000 telegrams to every door in Limerick and regions beyond. Mrs. O'Connell said a long time ago she knew everything about every telegram boy. She must know about the times I went at myself on top of carrier gunwale, milkmaids gawking, little boys looking up. She must know about Teresa Carmody in the green sofa, how I got her into a state of sin and sent her to hell, the worst sin of all, worse than Carrigogunnel 1,000 times. She must know I never went to confession after Teresa, that I'm doomed to hell myself. A person that commits a sin like that is never too good for the post office or anything else. The barman at South's remembers me from the time I sat with Mr. Hannon, Bill Galvin, Uncle Pat Keating, Black, White, Black. He remembers my father, how he spent his wages and his dole while singing patriotic songs and making speeches from the dock like a condemned rebel.
"And what is it you'd like?" says the barman.
"I'm here to meet Uncle Pat Keating and have my first pint."
"Oh, begod, is that a fact? He'll be here in a minute. And sure, there's no reason why I shouldn't draw his pint. And maybe draw your first pint, is there now?"
"There isn't, sir."
Uncle Pa comes in and tells me sit next to him against the wall. The barman brings the pints. Uncle Pa pays, lifts his glass, tells the men in the pub, "This is my nephew Frankie McCourt, son of Angela Sheehan, the sister of my wife, having his first pint. Here's to your health and long life, Frankie. May you live to enjoy the pint, but not too much."
The men lift their pints, nod, drink, and there are creamy lines on their lips and mustaches. I take a great gulp of my pint, and Uncle Pat tells me,
"Slow down, for the love of Jesus. Don't drink it all. There's more where that came from, as long as the Guinness family stays strong and healthy."
I tell him I want to stand him a pint with my last wages from the post office, but he says,
"No, take the money home to your mother, and you can stand me a pint when you come home from America, flush with success and the heat from a blonde hanging on your arm."
The men in the pub are talking about the terrible state of the world and how, in God's name, Hermann Göring escaped the hangman an hour before the hanging. The Yanks are over there in Nuremberg declaring they don't know how the Nazi bastard hid that pill. Was it in his ear? Up his nostril? Up his arse? Surely the Yanks looked in every hole and cranny of every Nazi they captured, and still Hermann wiped their eye. There you are. It shows you can sail across the Atlantic, land in Normandy, bomb Germany off the face of the earth, but when all's said and done, they can't find a little pill planted in the far reaches of Göring's fat arse. Uncle Pa buys me another pint. It's harder to drink because it fills me and makes my belly bulge. The men are talking about concentration camps and the poor Jews that never harmed a soul. Men, women, children, crammed into ovens. Children, mind you. What harm could they do? Little shoes scattered everywhere, crammed in. And the pub is misty and the voices fading in and out. Uncle Pa says, "Are you all right? You're as white as a sheet." He takes me to the lavatory, and the two of us have a good long piss against the wall, which keeps moving back and forth. I can't go into the pub again. Cigarette smoke, stale Guinness, Göring's fat arse, small shoes scattered. Can't go in again. "Good night, Uncle Pa. Thanks." And he tells me go straight home to my mother, straight home. All he doesn't know about the excitement in the loft, or the excitement on the green sofa, or me in such a state of doom that if I died now, I'd be in hell in a wink. Uncle Pa goes back to his pint. I'm out on O'Connell Street, and why shouldn't I take the few steps to the Jesuits and tell all my sins this last night I'll be 15? I ring the bell at the priest's house, and a big man answers, "Yes?" I tell him I want to go to confession, Father. He says, "I'm not a priest. Don't call me Father. I'm a brother." "All right, brother. I want to go to confession before I'm 16 tomorrow. Stay the grace of my birthday." He says, "Go away. You're drunk. Child like you, drunk as a lord, ringing for a priest at this hour. Go away or I'll call the guards."
I don't. I only want to go to confession. I'm doomed."
"You're drunk. And you're not in a proper spirit of repentance." He closes the door in my face. Another door closed in the face, but I'm 16 tomorrow, and I ring again. The brother opens the door, swings me around, kicks my arse, and sends me tripping down the steps. He says, "Ring this bell again, and I'll break your hand." Jesuit brothers are not supposed to talk like that. They're supposed to be like our Lord, not walk in the world threatening people's hands. I'm dizzy. I go home to bed. I hold on to railings along Barrington Street and keep to the wall going down the lane. Mam is by the fire smoking a woodbine. My brother's upstairs in the bed. She says, "That's a nice state to come home in." It's hard to talk, but I tell her I had my first pint with Uncle Pa. No father to get me the first pint. Your Uncle Pa should know better. I stagger to a chair and she says, just like your father. I try to control the way my tongue moves in my mouth. I'd rather be like my father than Lemon Griffin. She turns away from me and looks into the ashes in the range. But I won't leave her alone because I had my pint, 2 pints, and I'm 16 tomorrow, a man. Did you hear me? I'd rather be like my father than Lemon Griffin. She stands up and faces me. Mind your tongue, she says. Mind your own bloody tongue. Don't talk to me like that. I'm your mother. I'll talk to you any bloody way I like. You have a mouth like a messenger boy. Do I? Well, I'd rather be a messenger boy than the likes of Lemon Griffin, old drunker with a snotty nose in his loft and people climbing up there with him. She walks away from me and I follow her upstairs to the small room. She turns. Leave me alone, leave me alone. And I keep barking at her, Lemon Griffin, till she pushes me. Get out of this room. And I slap her on the cheek so the tears jump in her eyes and there's a small whimpering sound from her. You'll never have the chance to do that again. And I back away from her because there's another sin on my long list. And I'm ashamed of myself. I fall into my bed, clothes and all, and wake up in the middle of the night puking on my pillow. My brother's complaining of the stink, telling me, clean up, I'm a disgrace. I hear my mother crying and I want to tell her I'm sorry. But why should I after what she did with Lemon Griffin? In the morning, my small brothers are gone to school. Maliki is out looking for a job. Mam is at the fire drinking tea. I place my wages on the table by her elbow and turn to go. She says, do you want a cup of tea? No. 'Tis your birthday. I don't care. She calls up the lane after me. You should have something in your stomach. But I give her my back and turn the corner without answering. I still want to tell her I'm sorry, but if I do, I'll want to tell her she's the cause of it all. That she should not have climbed to the loft that night, and I don't give a fiddler's fart anyway because I'm still writing threatening letters for Mrs. Finucan and saving to go to America. I have the whole day before I go to Mrs. Finucan to write the threatening letters. And I wander down Henry Street till the rain drives me into the Franciscan church, where St. Francis stands with his birds and lambs. I look at him and wonder why I ever prayed to him. No, I didn't pray. I begged. I begged him to intercede for Teresa Carmody, but he never did a thing, stood up there on his pedestal with a little smile, the birds, the lambs, and didn't give a fiddler's fart about Teresa or me. I'm finished with you, St. Francis. Moving on. Francis. I don't know why they ever gave me that name. I'd be better off if they called me Maliki, one a king, the other a great saint. Why didn't you heal Teresa? Why did you let her go to hell? You let my mother climb to the loft. You let me get into a state of doom. Little children's shoes scattered in concentration camps. I have the abscess again. It's in my chest and I'm hungry. St. Francis is no help. He won't stop the tears bursting out of my two eyes, the sniffling and the choking, and the God of gods that had me on my knees, with my head in the back of the pew before me, and I'm so weak with the hunger and the crying, I could fall on the floor. And would you please help me, God or St. Francis, because I'm 16 today, and I hit my mother and sent Teresa to hell, and wanked all over Limerick and the county beyond, and I dread the millstone around my neck. There's an arm around my shoulders, a brown robe, click of black rosary beads, a Franciscan priest. My child, my child, my child. I'm a child and I lean against him, little Frankie on his father's lap. Tell me all about Cahool and Dad, my story that Maliki can't have or Freddie Leibowitz on the swings. My child, sit here with me. Tell me what troubles you, only if you want to. I'm Father Gregory.
I'm 16 today, Father.
Oh, lovely, lovely. And why should that be a trouble to you?
I drank my first pint last night.
Yes?
I hit my mother.
God help us, my child. But he'll forgive you. Is there anything else?
I can't tell you, Father.
Would you like to go to confession?
I can't, Father. I did terrible things.
God forgives all who repent. He sent his only beloved Son to die for us.
I can't tell, Father. I can't.
But you could tell St. Francis, couldn't you?
He doesn't have...